Once upon a time, Goldilocks discovered some delicious iced coffee in someone else's home.
This Dunkin' Cold is just right. And this Dunkin' Cold is just right. And this Dunkin' Cold is just right.
She sipped on and on, blissfully unaware that the bear stood watching.
Barry, say something.
Roar. Was that good?
The home with Dunkin' is where you want to be.
Welcome to Teacher Quit Talk. I'm Miss Redacted.
And I'm Mrs. Frazzled. Every week we explore the teacher exodus to find out what, if anything, could get these educators back in the classroom.
We've all had our moments where we thought, what the hell am I doing here? From burnout to bureaucracy to soul-sucking stressors and creative dead ends.
From recognizing when it was time to go to navigating feelings of guilt and regret afterwards, we're here to cut out the gaslighting and get real about what it means to leave teaching.
We've got insights from former teachers from all over the country who have seen it all. So get ready to be disturbed. Join us on Teacher Quit Talk to laugh through the pain of the U.S. education system. We'll see you there.
Hi, I'm Frances Callier.
And I'm Angela V. Shelton.
And we're Frangela.
You know what you need in your life? The Final Word podcast.
Yes, you do.
That's right. It is the final word on all things political and pop cultural.
Where we make real news real funny.
Where we inspire you so you can hashtag resist.
Subscribe and get a new episode of the Final Word podcast each week. It's the news we think you need to hear.
That's right. We think you need to hear it. Okay.
Yeah, it's what we say so.
That's right. And because all we do is give, every Thursday you can listen to our hysterical podcast, Idiot of the Week.
We round up the stupid because you know what? Somebody has to.
Okay. All we do is give.
Дамы и господа, это Prevail. И ваш ведущий Грег Олир.
I'm Greg Oliar. This is Prevail. Welcome to the program. We've got a great show today. Jameson Firestone is here, along with my friend Moscow Never Sleeps. We're going to talk to him in a minute. This is a, for me, kind of a mind-blowing conversation that we had that really put all of the stuff happening in Russia in perspective. Now, you may not be familiar with Jameson Firestone, but you probably are familiar with Bill Browder. You probably are familiar with Sergei Magnitsky and the Magnitsky Act. You've probably heard of Natalia Veselnitskaya, the Russian lawyer working for Putin that met with Junior and Kushner and Manafort at Trump Tower back on June 9th, 2016. Easy date to remember, 6-9. And you certainly have heard of Alexei Navalny. Now, Jameson Firestone has worked with, employed, or otherwise come into contact with all of these people during the time that he spent in Moscow operating a law firm there. He went to Moscow in 1991, while it was still the Soviet Union, Perestroika, Gorbachev. He went right after taking the bar exam, didn't even know if he passed it. He was looking for opportunity. He was looking for adventure. I think he got a lot more than he bargained for. I'm going to let him tell the story because it's really remarkable and it will crystallize your understanding of all the stuff that's now happening with Browder, Magnitsky, Putin, Veselnitskaya, all of it, Navalny. One of the most educational things you're going to listen to. Very, very happy with this interview. And thanks to Moscow Never Sleeps for helping out with it in the ways that he did. Now, I don't want to talk too long at the beginning because I want to get right to it. We're going to be right back with Jameson Firestone and Moscow Never Sleeps. But first, Lynn Wood. You remember Lynn Wood. He's that attorney that worked with Sidney Powell and Rudy Giuliani around the time of the insurrection, right? Trying to do the stop the steal and all that stuff. He's kind of the QAnon nut job. Well, come to find out, he's released an audiobook of basically a manifesto that he's written, which is called The Revelation of Lynn Wood the Divine. And we at Prevail were fortunate enough, maybe fortunate isn't the right word, we at Prevail obtained a short snippet of this audiobook, which we're going to play right now.
The revelation of Jesus Christ, which God gave unto him, and he sent and signified it by his angel unto his servant Lynn Wood. I was in the Spirit on the Lord's day, and heard behind me a great voice, as of a trumpet, saying, I am Alpha Bank and Omega Oil, the first and the last. And what thou seest, write in a book, or an email, or perhaps a series of TikTok videos, and send it unto Ephesus, and unto Smyrna, and unto Philadelphia at the Four Seasons Total Landscaping. Write the things which thou hast seen, and the things which are, and the things which shall be hereafter. And there appeared a great wonder in heaven, a woman clothed with the sun, and the moon under her feet, and upon her head a crown of 12 stars. And there appeared another wonder in heaven, and behold, a great red dragon, having 7 heads and 10 horns, and 7 crowns upon his heads. And these were the Conways, Kellyanne, and George. And I saw one like unto the Son of Man, clothed with a garment down to the foot, and girt about the paps with a golden girdle. And I could tell by the golden girdle that this was Donald Trump. And when I saw him, I fell at his feet as dead, and he laid his right hand upon me, saying unto me, Fear not, Linwood. I am the first and the last, the one true president. My letter is Q, and my hair is real, and my burger patty is well done, and my tax audit is everlasting.
Okay, we are recording. I am here with Moscow Never Sleeps, and we have a very special guest today. Jameson Firestone is with us. How are you?
Very well, thank you.
Great thanks to so be much here. Thanks for coming on the show. In my work in the last 4 years, which has nothing to do with my work in my previous incarnation of life, I've just studied and written a lot about Trump and Russia and all the sort of connections. And you're somebody who knows so much about this, so I'm excited to talk to you. And I'm sure my listeners will be as well, to kind of enlighten us about stuff that's happening and has happened, you know, with regards to Putin and Russia and the regime, and of course the Magnitsky Act and your work with that. So, but let's start early on. You went to Moscow in 1991. So tell us a little bit about who you are and your early career there. And why did you decide to go there? Sorry.
Seemed like a good idea at the time. So I'm a New York lawyer, but if you need a New York lawyer, don't call me. I've never practiced a day in my life in the state of New York. I took the New York bar in 1991. I got on a plane 1 week after taking the bar before I even got results passed or whatever, and went to Moscow because it was Gorbachev and, you know, develop democracy and a free market, right? And I got there literally right before Gorbachev was kidnapped, right before that putsch attempt.
Oh, God.
And I had no idea what I was going to do. But what I ended up doing was setting up Moscow's first foreign-owned independent law firm. And that became my business for the next 18 years in Moscow.
What was it like there at the time? It must have been like crazy. I always feel I'm of the age where I feel like I'm Gen X, but I'm later Gen X. I feel like I miss out on all the cool stuff. So I feel like Moscow in 1991 must have been like totally amazing in a lot of ways.
Well, you know, when I went over there, it was still the Soviet Union. It was August of 1991, and everything was, I mean, there was no traffic in the streets, and the only billboards were communist propaganda, even though it was the Gorbachev era. And then after Gorby was kidnapped, when he was returned, even though he was still president of the Soviet Union, there was this incredible feeling that Russians had stood in front of these tanks. It was grandmothers who stood in front of the tanks. It was grandmothers, the ones who yelled like, you can't cut in front of us in line. The same ones were standing in front of the tanks going, you're not going to run us over. We're your grandmothers. We're your mothers. And just yelling at the tank commanders, these young kids. And so all of a sudden, everything had changed overnight. And there was literally the statue of Lenin across the street from the Bolshoi Theater. Somebody had spray painted it in Russian with forgive me on Lenin, right, on Lenin. And Gorby basically, power just drifted away from him and went all to Yeltsin, even though there was no official recognition of this. And by Christmas of that year, the Soviet Union voted itself out of existence. And you had the independent Russia flying a different flag, not the communist Russian Republic flag, but the tricolor that they fly today. And everybody, it just felt like everything was possible. It felt like such a, it was such a, an era of possibility. If the people could do this, they could do anything. And Russia was going to have a great and free future. Now, of course, it didn't really turn out that way. And then, you know, as things went on, Yeltsin became kind of a drunkard and his family took more and more power unto themselves. And they did the shock theory where they just privatized everything and let the prices go where they were. And so what happened was, I mean, on the one hand, yeah, it was wild. I mean, it used to be at the point where if you wanted to go to a normal restaurant, and there weren't many, you had to bribe at the door, and then patio pizza opens up, and all of a sudden it's a restaurant where you don't have to bribe anybody to like get a table. It was great. but you had this dual system, like ruble, would you like to go to our ruble hall or our dollar hall? And the prices are the same, 100 rubles or $100. The only difference was 100 rubles was $3 and $100 was $100, right? But the $100 sign had no line, and the ruble sign, you know, they would, the guards would go, either it had a line around the block or the guards would go, we don't have any tables till Tuesday, expecting you to bribe them. And I would be like, oh, I live here. I'll come back on Tuesday. What time can I have a reservation? Right. But all that weirdness.
Jamie, do you remember what they were called? Those guys?
Oh, the guys who stood at the door?
Yep.
Well, I mean, at the clubs, we called them face control, but I don't know what they were called.
Yeah. But in the Soviet times, we called them Schwitzer, the Swiss guard.
No, I mean, it was crazy. But during that period between 1991, when the Soviet Union fell by voting itself out of existence, and 1993, when increasingly people were getting poorer and poorer, and the communists controlled the parliament, and Yeltsin controlled the presidency, and the parliament was impeaching the president, and the president was trying to dissolve parliament, and finally the parliamentarians occupied the White House. And as Alexei Navalny has said, and I said this as well, we both made the same mistake back then, which was we thought that because, you know, Yeltsin wasn't a communist, right? We were fully in favor of doing what was necessary to get out the communist people who had occupied the parliament. And you know, what Yeltsin eventually did was roll tanks in front of the parliament and shell it. And in retrospect, that was a terrible mistake. If you don't like the way your government is going, you don't shell Congress or storm Congress, right? You don't shell that, which is what they did. And so what they ended up getting was, you know, the path from that eventually led to the path towards Putin. So that was and just as an aside, I was there with my original law partner, who happened to be my closest friend, and the night before the shelling, we had been walking around the occupied White House because it was kind of like it was almost like a fairground. There was barbed wire everywhere, and the parliament was held up. And as we were walking around, this group of 10 people, we all got separated. And I remained with one friend, and we noticed that they were saying, take the TV station. People were standing on the balcony, parliamentarians, the vice president, take the TV station, get in the trucks, go to Ostankino, that's the TV tower. And these young people started to get into these trucks. Some of them had guns, but most of them had like clubs or pipe or whatever. And I remember just hearing a random woman speaking English. She goes, oh, I wouldn't miss this for the world. This is history being made. And I turned to my friend and I just said, we need to go home, because if Yeltsin doesn't kill all of these people tonight, there will be no Yeltsin government tomorrow. I mean, you can't take the national TV station. So we went home. And eventually, I got a call about 9 o'clock at night from my friend Michael O'Hare, who worked in the TV station, and he was screaming uncontrollably. And I was like, "What's going on? What's going on?" I said, "People drove a truck with a bomb through the Ostankino door, and there are snipers in the streets, and there's like 20 exits to Ostankino." We all went running out, and this is an American kid who was working for a Russian TV station. I ran to the first building that I could get, and I rang all the doorbells. Some babushka let me in. I'm in her apartment under a table with her, and snipers are taking out the windows. And oh my God. So unfortunately, that night, my best friend and partner didn't come back. And he was the only American casualty at Estancano. He had gone from the White House, the Parliament building where we had all gotten separated, to the TV tower. And as Russians were being shot by snipers, he was putting the wounded in the ambulances. And the New York Times 24-year-old American journalist by the name of Otto Pohl got shot twice. So my partner, law partner Terry, was pulling him back and was shot in the head while pulling Otto out of the line of fire. Otto did live. So, you know, times went from very, very wild and fun to very dark and scary quickly in 93. And then from 93 to 96, went out of control, where Yeltsin was drinking and he was having heart problems. And eventually, as you know, Yeltsin gave us the gift that kept on giving, Vladimir Putin, bringing him out in 1996, I believe it was, as our new leadership, or bringing him in 1996. I can't remember if it was 96 or 98. No, 96, he was lining him up. In 98, I think he became president.
We'll get to him. And okay. Very sorry to hear about the loss of your friend, but brave guy to be there at all and to be helping people. Everybody, I think, listening to this knows Magnitsky and has heard certainly the name before. And I want to get into the kind of specifics of who he was, what he was doing, what his relationship was with you, with Bill Browder, and why his memory has become kind of a rallying cry.
As I said, we set up this law firm, and our clients were basically foreigners entering the Russian market. And our whole premise was that one can do business legally in Russia. You can pay all your taxes and still make a profit. And so we were kind of in the business of bulletproofing our clients, making them so compliant that they couldn't be shook down for people who wanted bribes, that they could, if challenged by the authorities, go into a court of law and say, no, we don't owe those taxes, and fight them. So Sergei Magnitsky, he was the head of my tax and audit department, and a specialist in tax law specifically. Although he was a licensed auditor, his real practice was tax law. We did very few tax audits. And so the idea, you know, client comes to you, they say, we want to do business in Russia. How do we set up? And Sergei's like was always their first stop. I mean, maybe they'd meet me as the introduction, but Sergei would listen to them and say, okay, so this is how you want to do your business. This is how you want to structure. And we would set them up following basically Sergei's instructions, his blueprint, so to speak. And if they ever got in questions, and we would also keep, if they wanted us, keep their books or review their books. We had a whole team under Sergei that did nothing but review people's tax filings before they were filed to make sure that they filed the right amount and paid the right amount. So one day I get this idea, which was there were all these hedge funds in the late 90s and in the early 2000s coming into Russia. And Russia, in a way, is at the time was kind of antiquated. I mean, if you agreed to buy stock over the phone, you still needed a paper contract. So somebody would draft a paper contract to buy those shares, and you'd have to run around town getting it sold, signed. So you've got these hedge funds buying hundreds of millions of dollars worth of stock, and they're spending all their time running organizing contracts to run around town and accounting and tax. And they don't want to do any of this. They just want to buy and sell their stock. So I got this idea, why don't we become the back office for hedge funds? Why don't we promote this service using Sergei's team, where we'll say, okay, you want to set up a hedge fund in Russia, we'll show you how to do it legally. And more than that, we'll do all the accounting and auditing in the background, run all this stuff back and forth, and you basically just have to review it and sign on the dotted line. So in doing that, we picked up a very large portion of the hedge funds in Moscow, including William Browder's Hermitage Capital. So we set up Hermitage Capital. We gave them the advice on how to structure in Russia. And Hermitage went on to make an awful lot of money. They, at the time, by 2006, so also I should say something about Bill. So Bill Browder's strategy was a little weird. What he would do is he would invest in companies where lots of stealing was going on and which had been undervalued because of the stealing. And then he would expose all the stealing and try and force the management out. And he had been very successful at doing this. And as soon as you force the old guys out, the share price goes up and you're holding the shares bought at this price before that happened. So
well, that's interesting. Yeah.
Yeah. So that was his way of he was calling himself an activist investor. And so Bill was picking fights with major, major oligarchs and winning. It was really amazing. And one of the first things that Bill did when Vladimir Putin came into power was Bill was a huge investor in Gazprom, the state gas company, was he presented a dossier on all the stealing going on in Gazprom. And Vladimir Putin's team used that to totally throw out all of the Gazprom management and put in new management, and the stock really went up. And then they stole more than the previous management. So Bill's team, you know, tried to go down the board, and they put in a whole other dossier to expose this stealing, thinking that Vladimir Putin was a really good guy because he acted on their last thing. And they didn't understand that Putin wasn't a good guy acting on their last thing. Putin used their last expose as an excuse to throw out a group of thieves so he could put in his own thieves. And now when Bill's team was exposing the new stealing, it's like, no, those are our guys. That's not, yeah. You can't. So they blocked Bill Browder from coming back into the country as a threat to national security. Bill tried a few times to get back into Russia, couldn't fix it. And so what he did was he liquidated his entire Gazprom portfolio because he couldn't get back into the country. And it just so happened that when he did it at the absolute top of the market. I mean, the prices had never been higher, and they've never been higher since, by the way. So he liquidated, it's about $2 billion worth of Gazprom. He made about $1 billion profit at the time. No, he made $5 billion in Gazprom, $2 billion worth of profit. And he had to pay 25% on that $2 billion in profit, which was $500 million in tax. So we oversaw that. We're the guys like actually filling out the tax. So one day, Sergei Magnitsky comes into my office. He goes, he's standing in front of my desk. Jefferson, you want to hear a funny story? I'm like, he goes, I just got called in by the tax inspectors. And I'm like, well, did it go all right? He goes, well, I mean, it depends whose perspective you're talking about. I mean, I think the head of the tax inspector was very upset. I said, why? He said, well, they said, you paid all this tax. You paid all this tax at once. And Sergei goes, well, I know. I mean, that's what we owe. He goes, but no, you don't understand. I get a budget of how much tax I need to collect every year. And you've just paid 10 times the budget that I'm supposed to collect. So they're going to give me a budget bigger than this next year, and I won't be able to make this collection budget. You're making my life difficult by paying all these taxes. And Sergei's like, wait a minute. Oh, you know, we can't control when we pay the taxes. We have to pay them now. Sorry, your life's going to be difficult. And, so we're laughing about this. But, then what happened wasn't so funny after we paid all these taxes. I mean, so that was when Bill left, we liquidated, we paid this $500 million worth of tax, and Bill gave us the mandate, Hermitage said, now liquidate all those empty companies for us. They've paid their tax, they sent their profits out. We got, we got our $1.5 billion post-tax profit. We've paid $500 million in tax. These are just empty companies, liquidate them. And so we were calmly liquidating when the troubles hit.
That's really, I didn't know that about the, it's so messed up. I think some of this bureaucracy is ingrained in the culture there, like the Soviet bureaucracy. Because as I understand it, when people go through now and try to study things, there's paper trails of everything and anything that ever happened, even during Stalin, no matter how crazy or how many people died or whatever, there's just this paper trail and this need for this paper trail that's deeply kind of embedded in the culture.
Yeah, I mean, one of the things that we found was that the reason we know so much and have exposed so much was after Sergei's death, we've got the orders to beat him while he's dying with rubber truncheons. And the guy, we've got the name of the guy who signed off on that and the name of the 8 officers authorized to do the beating. They document everything.
Oh, that's just awful.
After we paid all those taxes, the Russians found a creative way to steal half back. So they stole back 230 million of the 500 million that Bill paid. And Sergei was the one who figured out that they had stolen the tax back. And he, because they did that switcheroo, remember Putin was president, but he switched with Medvedev and became prime minister. And our new lawyer president, Medvedev, was saying everybody must fight legal nihilism, you know, fight corruption. So Sergei acted on that. He reported the crime that $230 million had been stolen from his own government by corrupt officials. And those same corrupt officials put him in prison, held him there for a year, tortured him, and eventually killed him in a Russian prison. So when they killed Sergei, Bill Browder, who was this, you know, billionaire hedge fund guy, pulled like a Bruce Wayne. He hung up his business and turned his hedge fund office into like the Bat Cave and hired, you know, his entire legal team and analyst team, no longer to analyze the value of stocks, but to figure out who stole the money, to build on Sergei's findings and to trace the money, to actually trace the money to different officials who Sergei had accused. And we did that. So after we managed to find, for instance, $3 million going to the police officer whose team arrested Sergei and had participated in the theft, we found $1.3 million that went to another one. The grandmotherly ladies in the tax office who refunded the $230 million, three grandmotherly like ladies, put $42 million in their pockets. So when we found this, Bill funded me to make some videos, and I made these great YouTube videos exposing these officers, showing exactly what they did and how much money they got and the property they bought and who was holding it and where it was being held. And it was a sensation. We got millions of viewers and everybody in Russia, nobody had seen anything like this before. And we couldn't get any criminal cases opened. The higher police would investigate and say, oh, the police officers were just naturally rich. They have rich parents. And of course, we found them living on $300 a month in their apartments that they got from the Soviet Union, right? And the tax officials, they had all the money in their parents' name. The parents are living in a broom closet somewhere. I mean, there's a special place in hell for people who steal $42 million and let their parents live in squalor, right? Yeah, but we couldn't get any action. So Bill, what do you do when the country that's supposed to be prosecuting people, its corrupt officials, doesn't? So Bill got this idea, which was when you steal money, you want to spend it. And Russians like to keep their money and spend their money abroad. That's the whole thing. They can't keep it in Russia because there's always a bigger fish than them that's going to steal the money from them. And they can't. You know, they can't buy the same stuff in Russia. They can't eat it. They want to go to the south of France. They want to have their kids educated here. So the idea was, why not just get them blocked from doing that? Because every country controls its own immigration and has control over the assets in its jurisdiction. So in theory, the United States can say, you know, we don't want crooks and thieves in our country. And if you have any money here, we'll freeze it. So he got this idea of doing that. And through Kyle Parker, who was working with Senator Cardin and a bunch of other senators, they put together a draft law, the Magnitsky Act. And the Magnitsky Act initially said anybody involved in the crime of stealing this money or killing Sergei or covering up that crime could be blocked from the United States and have their assets frozen. And anybody who attacks people like Sergei. So if you attack a journalist, if you attack a human rights activist, if you attacked an anti-corruption activist, if you did the kinds of things that you had that were done to Sergei, all of those people would be banned as well. But it only applied to Russia. And we got the Magnitsky Act passed in the United States in 2012. And Putin was going crazy. He was lobbying against it. He was, and we didn't, you know, look, we didn't get any support from the Obama administration on this because President Obama was in the, you know, had ordered Hillary Clinton to make nice with the Russians and push the reset button. So they were all trying, you know, to do their big love fest. And we had to go essentially over their heads and go to Congress and get the Magnitsky Act passed by Congress with enough support that it would have withstood a veto. So Obama signed it into law. So we got the Magnitsky Act. Putin went nuts. He did two things. He couldn't retaliate the same way, kind of. I mean, he did. He passed a special law called the Dima Yakovlev Act. And what it did was it stopped all the prosecutors who put Victor Boot, the Merchants of Death, in prison. So if anybody, if you were involved in putting the Merchant of Death in prison, you could no longer come to Russia, right?
Oh, no. So here I can't we are, have right? my money
we're,
in
we're,
Russia.
We're like punishing human rights abusers and saying, if you're a human rights abuser, you can't come to America. And they're saying, if you persecute Russian gun runners and weapon, you know, and arms traders. And the other thing they did, which was really terrible, was they said Americans could no longer adopt Russian children.
Right.
And this was terrible because Americans were adopting about 4,000 Russian kids a year. They were only taking kids who had physical or psychological problems because you weren't allowed to adopt perfectly healthy kids. These kids were languishing in orphanages and had no chance whatsoever. And a lot of them could live very normal lives with the kind of care that we have available in America. And they stopped that. And 300 families were in the process of adoptions where the kids had met the parents already, stopped that too. That brought 20,000 Russians onto the street in protest. The march against scoundrels, where they said, you know, how could Putin attack the children, the weakest children of our country? So that was the original Magnitsky Act. And I should say we expanded it in 2016. We expanded the Magnitsky Act by saying it should include, first of all, it should be worldwide, and it should include corruption. Corruption should be a reason that gets you sanctioned and can't come to the United States. Mm-hmm. And if you think that human rights bothered Vladimir Putin, it didn't bother him anywhere near as the idea as corruption gets you blocked from the United States and your money frozen. And he went nuts. And to give you an idea how much he went nuts, we had a Bill Browder had given the SDNY, Southern District of New York, a dossier on money laundering that was going through New York, money that had come from the crime that Sergei discovered, and it was used to buy property in New York City. And so he went to Preparaha. He opened a criminal case, a civil case, but he froze all of that property. And the general prosecutor of Russia said something very, very important, because they had been denying the whole story of, they, at this point, they were saying the theft from the treasury, our officials didn't do it. It was Browder, it was Magnitsky, it was Firestone. And the general prosecutor said something very interesting when SDNY froze these properties. They said, if this case is proven in a US court, money laundering from this crime, it will validate the entire Browder Magnitsky narrative. It will mean that the money was really stolen, and it will validate the reason for having sanctions named for Sergei Magnitsky. And of course, Russia couldn't have that happen. So what Russia did was something crazy. The lead lawyer defending these alleged money launderers was an unknown woman by the name of Natalia Veselnitskaya. And they deputized her. They went to this woman and they said, we have the same problem. Your client is being sued by the U.S. because of information provided by the Browder team. And we need to discredit their true narrative. We have to say that they're crooks and thieves. So here's what's going to happen. You now work for the Russian government secretly, and anything you need from us, we'll give you. So what would happen is during the trial, the U.S. government would write through the Justice Department, make a formal request. The U.S. Department of Justice requests the U.S. Ministry, the Russian Ministry of Justice, to provide information on this case and these particular people who are accused of money laundering. They would then send an email to Veselnitskaya, who is the defense attorney, secretly. Hey, boss, what do you want us to say to this one? Right? She would write the answer. Right? Say, put this on Justice Ministry stationery. The Russian Federation Ministry of Justice has fully investigated this case and found that these people are completely innocent. And it's Browder, Magnitsky, and Firestone who are the crooks that stole this money. Please put that on Russian Ministry of Justice letterhead and send that to the US DOJ. And they got caught. But they didn't get caught immediately. See, before they got caught, she was rather active. She hired Glenn Simpson, who did the PP dossier, and had him go to Congress and call us crooks and thieves. She went to Congress and also said that we were all crooks and thieves. And then she took a little stop, a little detour, after Trump had won the election, but before he was sworn in. And she met with the Trump incoming team in Trump Tower, the infamous Trump Tower meeting. This is the same Veselnitskaya. And the whole subject of the meeting was Browder, Magnitsky and Firestone are crooks. And if you kill the sanctions, right, you can have good relations with Russia and you can start adopting kids again. Now, let me, since this is deal talk, right, because Trump likes to talk in deals. I mean, he wasn't there, but his kids were there. So the deal is, let our crooks come to your country, keep their money in your bank, and you'll have good relations with Russia. So basically, all you have to do is be nice to Russian crooks, and you get good relations with Russia. That is the secret. There is no other secret. The Veselnitskaya delivered the message in Trump Tower.
Despite doing that,
we did get the all of this blew up in their faces. Their entire defense team was disqualified. Veselnitskaya was indicted, but she was already back in Russia, and her client settled without an admission of guilt, but paid almost $6 million. And the Magnitsky Act was expanded to include corruption. And Vladimir Putin really doesn't like Browder or myself or anything.
Which is a badge of honor.
The Magnitsky Acts are being adopted all over the world. So they've been, there's one adopted in Canada. There's one adopted in the EU. The UK has a Magnitsky Act that includes both human rights and corruption. And so it's going to be the norm to have Magnitsky sanctions where you essentially say, we don't want odious crooks in our nation. And that's becoming the norm. And that's the legacy that we've built for Sergei. And it makes the world a better place. It doesn't just apply to Russia anymore.
It sure does. Moscow, what were you going to say?
I mean, the deal that she was trying to offer the American government is the deal that they had offered the UK government. And for the most part, they achieved. I mean, for the longest time, you know, London was quite at home with turning a blind eye on it. And, you know, you can go into a couple of explanations of the differences in the past between how the UK looks at this sort of thing and how the US looks at this sort of thing. But the great news is just 2 weeks ago, the UK appears to have tracked almost completely to the U.S. position on how and why to enforce Magnitsky. And that is a huge disappointment to the Kremlin.
Yeah, and it was done, by the way, I should say, because the Russians killed a lot of people in the U.K.
Which even the British object to after a while.
Right. So, you know, look, the first time when the Russians killed Litvinenko, there was a very serious freeze in relations here. But the freeze in relations had a financial effect, and the government here got cold feet and all of a sudden went in for the Russian love fest again for all the money. And we had a lot of other murders that occurred here, including somebody who gave me documents. We're pretty sure he was poisoned. He gave me documents to make an expose of the tax inspectors. 44 years old, died vomiting green goo, you know, here in Surrey. But what the straw that broke the camel's back, of course, was the Skripals. So the Russians sent two guys over here to poison the Skripals. They used a nerve agent that they put on their doorknob. So not only did they almost kill the Skripals, but the police officer who came in and opened the door to their house almost died. And then they just callously threw out the poison in a dumpster, which was later found by somebody because it was still in its expensive fake Nina Ricci, you know, box. And so a guy brought it home to his wife, who sprayed it on her and died. And that's what it took to bring the British around, that the Russians had to unfortunately kill quite a few people in the UK before the British went, okay, this enough is enough. We also need to draw a line somewhere.
This is interesting. Going back to something you were saying earlier about the concept of bringing wealth out of the country of Russia and why to do it, it reminded me of the Tiflis bank robbery in 1906, 1907, which Stalin was involved in, you know, to raise money for the Bolshevik cause. They boosted this bank in Tiflis, which I don't know what it's called now, is the capital of Georgia, which is where Stalin was from. And they stole all these at the time. They had these really enormous banknotes that were, you know, 500 rubles or whatever. And I think they were backed by gold at the time. I might have one in my drawer here. Whatever. You know what they look like. And the government, the Romanov government, immediately demonetized all of the banknotes. They were like, oh, these big ones, they're not valid anymore. So the guy that robbed the bank had all of these banknotes that suddenly became absolutely worthless. So it's the same thing in a much larger scale, right? Where you're, okay, you've taken all this money, which, by the way, is stolen from the Russian people. They're not stealing money, which I think is an important distinction to make. They're not stealing money from a corporation or from the mobster or this or that. They're taking it directly from the coffers of the Russian people. Before we move on, I always forget to do this. We're going to take a short break, and we'll be right back with Moscow Never Sleeps, Jameson Firestone.
I'm former FBI Assistant Director Frank Figluzzi. Join me on a journey deep inside the world's premier law enforcement agency, to decode the mysteries and challenges of today's FBI. In this first-of-a-kind podcast, we'll sit down with active-duty FBI personnel who reveal their mission, their cases, and their lives.
The commonalities that we're looking at with the Highway Serial Killings Initiative are dealing with the long-haul trucking industry.
These offenders, as they plan, prepare, and consider for their attack, don't do that in a vacuum. Even if they end up alone at the end, that doesn't mean they started off alone.
The pattern of this bedspread, what stores it would have been sold at, an outlet club, tips that lead us to possibly identifying that victim.
Let's go inside the Bureau with Frank Figluzzi.
Okay, we're back with Jameson Firestone, Moscow Never Sleeps, and I. We're laughing because it's funny because we didn't actually take a break. We took like a 5-second break where we all had a sip of water. let's talk now about what's happening in Russia now and what's happening going forward. I have, first of all, early on, you mentioned Navalny and that you said way back in the day that he made a mistake. What do you think of him going back to Russia now? Because I wonder if he's having second thoughts.
I would doubt he's having second thoughts. Look, I've known Alexei since 2009, and we really hit it off. I mean, he basically stole his movie-making technique from me, and the student has become the master. I bow before him. He made an expose of the general prosecutor of Russia, where he showed that the general prosecutor of Russia, his whole family was in business with the bloodiest mafiosi in Russia. And because it was so similar to my videos, the GP accused us openly of you know, funding it or directing it or whatever, and we had no involvement. It was his work. Look, I think people always ask Alexei or myself or Bill, you know, are you afraid of doing this? Why do you need to do this? And, you know, the answer is, I need to do this because I can't look at myself in the mirror if I don't do this. I mean, Bill and I do this thing for Sergei. My focus is a bit wider in that it includes just Russia, because I very much felt that Russia was my country. I don't mean that I ever ceased to be American, but I lived in Russia for 18 years and I love Russia. I don't love the Putin government. And I don't love the Putin, you know, what the Putin government is doing to Russia. But I, in some ways, my work is very patriotic in that the more of these crooks and thieves we expose in the Russian government, the better the Russian people are, right? The more people see this. So we can't be another way. And when Alexei's asked the same question, and he has been many times, he's like, you know, it makes me so angry that they're stealing from me. The people who are stealing from me are the people whose salaries I pay. I'm paying the man who's putting me in prison. I'm paying that fake kangaroo court judge who's breaking the law. And there are, you know, this is his passion. This is what he cares about. I mean, obviously he cares about his wife and his kids too, but look, you get one life and everybody's going to die sooner or later. And that's just the way it goes. Right. And this is what he cares about. And it's not, you know, his lot is to fight this fight. And if it kills him, his family will be very sad and very proud at the same time. And they understand, and that's the way he feels. And he's not going to be in exile. This is, you know, this is his country. You know, Hudorkovsky didn't want to leave, but Hudorkovsky's a different guy. You know, Hudorkovsky's never going to be, he wasn't an anti-corruption activist. He is now, but you know, however he made his first God knows what, Alexei's a very different character. He is This is his passion. This is his country. He will either, you know, be Mandela and president of Russia or dead. There's very little in between for him.
It's enormously brave. I mean, when I read about what he's doing, you just sort of put yourself in that position. And I'm like, I wouldn't go back. That's just me. He's brave. He's historically, if you think about it in a history book sense, it's absolutely the right call. But man, I'm sort of in awe of the bravery that took, because whew.
Yeah. And
so, I just want to jump in for 2 seconds and ask 2 questions to kind of guide this. One, there's always been a bit of like back detraction on Navalny. You know, he's a nationalist. He's an anti-Semite. He's a this, he's a that. And I've always got the sense that, you know, they take a couple remarks of his about, you know, immigration or stuff like that out of context, and they use it to try to drive a wedge into his his generally liberal base of support.
Look, I've had ongoing discussions with people at Amnesty International about this and others. So the first thing Alexei ever said to me when I met him back in 2009, we were sitting in a roof bar, is, you know, I said, tell me about yourself, because I'm a nationalist. I said, what? You know, I mean, as a Jewish kid from New York, that's usually about the last, that usually is the conversation ender when somebody tells me that they're a nationalist, right?
Right.
So I asked him, you know, explain it. And by the way, he's got a book written about this. So Alexei is, you have to remember, Russia had no immigration laws at all for like 10 years. I mean, no immigration, just come, right, from the neighboring republics, which caused all sorts of problems. I mean, it's not just, oh, people are taking our jobs. It's, you know, there's no vetting of the people who come in. There's complete abuse of those people, where they take them in work sites and they put them in containers, and it was a mess. And Alexei was campaigning hard and rudely and crudely for immigration law. And he was never in any ways a racist in any way. He wasn't trying to stop immigration, but he absolutely wanted sane immigration laws with controls and reasons to let in and reasons to expel. And he never hid that. Alexei Navalny used to march in this nationalist march every year. And he would march, I'm forgetting her name right now, but she's very famous. For 3 years in a row, he marched with his Jewish friend who wore a huge Star of David on her chest, marching next to Alexei Navalny with a bunch of nationalists. And all these nationalists would be coming up. And she said, yeah, he took a lot of shit for me trying to explain, you know, trying to talk sense to angry nationalists. But he basically felt that you have to talk to the people who are irrationally anti-immigrant, right? And try and win them over to the position of, it's okay to have laws. It's not okay to be a bigot. It's not okay. And so he's, whatever Alexei is, he's not a bigot on any level. And I think Amnesty made a terrible mistake, because they played into the hands of the Russians. The Russian government, when he was named prisoner of consciousness, sent around all this, you know, all these remarks out to try and make him look like he was some kind of a racist or something, or that he was guilty of hate speech, so that they would remove that designation so that there would be less international support for him. Now, Amnesty is still kicking it around, but I mean, I think Amnesty has hurt themselves and isn't doing any help for Alexei here either. They should restore that status as quickly as possible.
That was exactly my position as well. I just wanted to hear you guys, you know, explicate it. So here's the second thing is, and this is from last night, Navalny obviously has a lot of files and a lot of people giving him information. And so what he did was he put them with Khodorkovsky. And last night, Khodorkovsky has said, look, I've got a list and it's going to go out because if anything happens to Navalny in prison, this stuff is going to explode the Magnitsky Act. It's just going to add names all over it. So, you know, what are you hearing about that? And you know, where do you think this is going in the next 6 to 12 months?
You know, look, there's no question that a lot of dossiers are going to be prepared and a lot of people are going to be lined up for sanctions. And whether they get sanctions or not is going to depend on what Russia does here, right? I mean, there are all sorts of ways to sanction Russians, by the way, which is funny because you have these things called Ukraine sanctions, and Ukraine sanctions actually say the following. You can be sanctioned for being an official of the Russian government, full stop. You don't actually have to be connected to Ukraine. You don't even have to do anything wrong. So right now, every official of the Russian government is eligible for sanctioning in America. And it's a discretionary thing. You know, Treasury has to make a decision or not. Plus, you have the Magnitsky Act, which allows you to sanction people who are corrupt or people who are human rights violators. And so you've got a lot of people compiling lists and dossiers and files on people who should be subject to sanctions, should, you know, Navalny die, or should they not release people who they're detaining? And look, there may be sanctions anyway. I mean, the fact of the matter is they've just destroyed Navalny's entire organization. Navalny's organization is only dedicated to two things, both of which are criminal in Russia: fighting corruption and free and fair elections. Right. So these two things this has been declared essentially the equivalent of a foreign funded terrorist network in Russia, and is being dismantled and his people are being attacked. And, you know, I think that there are governments all over the world now trying to think how best to react to this. What's the proper thing to do now? There are criminal cases being prepared against, additional criminal cases being prepared against Navalny so that they can keep him in, because he's only got like 2 years or something. That's not enough for Putin, right? And there are additional criminal cases being prepared against everybody high up in his network. I mean, there's a goal here, which is to make sure that Vladimir Putin not only stays in power, but that they're allowed to continue stealing. Because what's the point? I mean, right now, he's got two aims about being in power. One is he always mentions Gaddafi, right? Because, you know, Gaddafi was pulled out of a car. Somebody took a pipe where the sun doesn't shine and impaled him. His last words were, "This isn't permitted by law," right? And then they dragged his body around. And Vladimir Putin sees that happening to him. And so Vladimir Putin can't leave. Because if he leaves, that could happen to him, right? So he's only got two goals. One is staying in power, and the other is keeping them all rich and trying to keep the West open so they can spend it, which means fighting Magnitsky sanctions, because other than staying alive, you know, they want to enjoy those yachts and they want to enjoy Western medical care. And we have to expand the sanctions. The sanctions we have now are not enough. The sanctions we have now, I go sanction some guy and his kids can come over. And that's not right. It's not a question of, if you go, oh, you know, why should you, you know, punish the kids for the sins of the fathers? Because it's their money you're spending. Right. You see, you're spending the proceeds of crime. And so I'm not really punishing you. What I'm doing is I'm saying, you can't bring that dirt into my country. Or if it's in my country, we're taking it away from you. And so we have to expand the sanctions, one, so that they touch the family members of these people, because that's where the money ends up. And the other thing that has to happen is, right now, your chance of being hit by Magnitsky sanctions is slightly, you know, maybe less than being hit by lightning. Because what happens is you need the bandwidth of the State Department or Congress or some other organization in another country, the analog, to focus on sanctioning some bad guys. So if I put some dossiers behind you, I got to get people to look at those dossiers, right? And so normally what happens is we put the dossiers behind in front of people. People don't do anything. Then Russia does something really, really, really obnoxious, right? And then all the dossiers are pulled out, you know, and they play them out. They go, okay, we're going to focus for like 2 days and we're going to sanction these six guys. And then, you know, we all go off until they do something bad again. That's not how this should work. The way this should be working, this should be a very routine way of just putting all these corrupt officials on every quarter, all over the world, coordinated, and not just in Russia, but in wherever there's corruption like this. And so that you get all the judges who put Navalny in prison and all the fake prosecutors who put him in prison and everybody who signed off on that and all the analogs that are happening in countries in Africa, you know, all these people should be, you should have eventually, essentially a list of thousands and thousands of people who are not welcome in first world democracies. And that list should grow you know, exponentially, because that's when it becomes a deterrent. That's when people start saying, oh, so Mr. Putin, you want me to put Navalny in prison, right? I've been a judge for 25 years. I've taken so many bribes. I think I can afford to retire right now. So the next guy comes, right? I'm retiring also. I'm not doing that because they don't want to get on the sanctions list. And when you get a whole bunch of officials who just aren't going to persecute people like Navalny or reporters or commit human rights violations, all of a sudden the world will change. So we need this expansion, wholesale expansion of the sanctions, so they include families, and so that there's some way to process a huge amount of them on an ongoing basis and coordinate it with other countries that have Magnitsky Acts.
Hear, hear, and amen. And, you know, our work is cut out for us on this front, because even with that, it's hard. They're so clever, these people, at getting the money in. I mean, I've been reading this book called Moneyland by Oliver. It's but mind blow the stuff that the ways that people come up with to skirt the regulations and the blocks in place. So we have to at least, you know, start off at a point where we're in a unified front coming together to, you know what it reminds me of? My kids are in high school and they're doing the Zoom school. It's not really Zoom, it's Google, whatever, but these poor teachers are trying to like regulate what the kids are doing. And anytime you have a bunch of middle-aged teachers versus a bunch of kids with technology, that the kids are going to win. I mean, they have this whole shit figured out with they're on Discord and they're doing this and they're doing that. And the teachers don't even know what hit them. And in this sense, we're the teachers and the kids are running amok and we have to put some discipline and order in place. I want to ask one more question before we go. This has been so interesting. Thank you so much for coming, because this is so much to think about. It's really been enlightening for me. And I'm sure enlightening to everybody listening. You mentioned Putin. And I think you framed it really well about, you know, what his options are going forward. I've listened to Craig Unger and Yuri Svets, who was the ex-KGB guy who's been working for the Americans for years and years. He seems to think that what follows Putin is going to be something worse than Putin. It's going to be the real bad guys from the FSB that are going to come into the forefront. So what do you think is going to happen there? I mean, idealistically and also realistically, what's your crystal ball?
Well, I mean, my crystal ball is it's going to be like the death of Stalin. You know, nobody thought Khrushchev was going to be the last man standing, and, you know, surprise, surprise. And, you know, in the case of Nikita Khrushchev, that was actually a good move. You know, I mean, we did get the Cuban Missile Crisis later, but the point is that whole thaw was instrumental in opening up and sharing with the Russian people what had really been going on, that this whole country, that 20 million people had been killed, and that there was a network of concentration camps, the gulag, completely across the country for people who did nothing wrong. So, you know, my argument to that, Russians go, well, you know, if not Putin, then who, right? Look, we've got bad. We've got really terrible right now. We've got somebody who runs Russia like a KGB officer should run Russia, where they've taken control of all of the media, where everything is propaganda, where everything that threatens that system is a crime, and where they have a right to steal from you, where the whole system is built on their right to steal from the Russian people. And that's the system that they're trying to export abroad, right? Just no sanctions and we'll have good relations. Don't punish our crooks and we'll have good relations. And by the way, we become like them when we allow it here. You have to understand, it's not like they become more like us. They come into these systems and we're all running for their money and we're all doing things, we're cleaning their money and we're arguing their cases in courts. And don't get me wrong, I mean, I've defended Russians before. It's difficult, you know, when somebody comes to you and says, hey, defend me, I'm gonna pay you this much money, or hey, I wanna buy that house and you're a broker, you're gonna make a £2 million fee on it. You know, for our own protection, we have to keep this out. So in answer to your question, I don't know what's going to happen next. What I know is what we have now is very bad. You have a guaranteed, this is bad for Russia and this is bad for the world. So if you want to use the expression that something that it could be worse afterwards, right? Hey, it can always be worse, right? I mean, don't leave your house. It could be bad out there, right? I mean, it's just a bad argument. I mean, we try and make things better. That's what, you know, Bill and I tried to do with the Magnitsky sanctions, and that's what Navalny is doing, risking his life sitting in a Russian jail. And I just hope that one day Russians have the the strength to just, you know, they don't have to do anything violent. They go out in the street. They listen, you have millions of people standing out on the street saying, we're not going to work until this guy's gone, right?
Yeah.
They'll go.
I hope that's what happens. And I think as we're recording this, President Biden has just addressed Congress for the first time in his presidency. I was encouraged by what I heard from him with regards to Putin. I think he's playing it really well. And I think he gets it. I really do. And unlike, and that's so critical, this reset idea is so just dunderheaded and it's got to go. And I think with Biden, he understands it because not only does he see it geopolitically, but also it's personal for him. It went after his kid. You know, he knows the score. So I think that while he might not, you know, communicate it to us in a way that makes us happy, I think behind the scenes, he really does know what the dangers are. And he's going to work, you know, to get to the result that we all want, which is Putin going bye-bye. Lord knows the guy's done so much wrong for Russia, for the United States, for world peace, frankly, because by weakening the NATO alliance and undermining all of that stuff, it threatens another world war, point blank. I mean, it's crazy. So I hope that that it works out and that he goes and Navalny succeeds him and we live happily ever after. But, you know, I'm a novelist. I like happy endings. What can I say? I'm an optimist. Jameson Firestone, thank you so much for joining. This was so great. Thank you.
Yeah, thank you so much.
Thank you for, and thanks for having me on.
Prevail theme song is by Matthew Fassa. Sofia Tereshchenko provided the Russian voiceover. Thanks to Stephanie St. John for the narration. Thanks to Allison Gill, Jason Smith, Mackenzie Mizell, and everyone else involved with producing this podcast. Please subscribe to the Prevail website. Visit gregoliar.com. That's GREGOLEAR.com. Until next time, we shall prevail.
Are you struggling to lower your bad LDL cholesterol, even though you may be taking a statin, swapping steaks for salads, and exercising while listening to this podcast? Ask your doctor if Repatha Evolocumab is right for you. With Repatha, you can dramatically reduce bad cholesterol and the risk of another heart attack while enjoying life too, because you're human. And with convenient self-administration, you can take Repatha in the comfort of your own home. Do not take Repatha if you're allergic to it. Repatha can cause serious allergic reactions. Signs include trouble breathing or swallowing, or swelling of the face. Most common side effects include runny nose, sore throat, common cold symptoms, flu or flu-like symptoms, back pain, high blood sugar and redness, pain, or bruising at the injection site. Visit Repatha.com or call 1-844-REPATHA. Talk to your doctor today about Repatha.